This is Holistic Health Masterclass Podcast, and I'm your host, Brett Horse. Welcome back, everyone, and just wanted to say thank you for your patience. I have been on a bit of a hiatus for the last couple of weeks, a bit of fun, bit of work, bit of business, but really just connecting, and from personal level, feeling pretty recharged. I attended a pretty epic event out in California on the edge of the Mojave Desert, which was really 5 days of just amazing food, yoga, connecting to people, and really soaking up the California sunshine and hanging out with some pretty awesome people from my Purium tribe. If you don't know what Purium is, it's a company that I work with based in California where we are all about superfoods and super awesome programs that have really helped to date over 1,100 of my clients in my practice so far. So if you are interested in any of those, definitely keep an eye out on my Facebook page, on the website, and basically just stay tuned in. Also been doing some trainings out in Ottawa for the last couple of days with my good friend, and really talking to other health professionals about whole foods, supplements, and products and whatnot. But we're back today, and I have a brand new episode. That's really what you're listening to right now. And it's really, it's an interesting episode because it's really a mix of tragedy, but powerful insight, and it's just really, really eye-opening to see what's going on in the background with regards to our access to natural health, our freedom of choice, and how government, Health Canada, pharma, big pharma are really running in the background and trying to suppress all of this and trying to sort of further their agenda. Now, for some of you listening, you might sort of go, well, we're stepping into the world of conspiracy theories and all sorts of other nonsense. But I think that once you listen to David Stefan's story, I think you might change your mind a little bit. And, you know, in my circles, and I'm sure many of you listening to this, you know, it's not the first time you've heard about something like this. But I want to give you the cliff notes on this episode before you actually listen to it. David Stefan is based out west in Alberta, and comes from a family that owns a supplement company called True Hope. And their entry into the world of supplements was quite interesting because it really was born out of necessity to a degree, where multiple family members had mental health issues and were on pharmaceuticals and whatnot, and it just wasn't working. Not just that it wasn't working, it was actually pretty detrimental, where people died, and you know, it just wasn't a good scene. And so that it almost forced them to seek out natural means and alternative medicine, and they sort of stumbled upon that, and it worked fantastically well for them, and they turned that into a business and turned that into helping other people, and there's glowing testimonials. But that's the small portion of what we talk about today. The main focus of today's episode is the tragic story of David's son, Ezekiel, and his tragic passing a few years ago. And long story short, I'll let you listen to the episode, but his son died of a different form of meningitis, and they didn't actually know that he had meningitis up until the real last minute. And the natural medicine that they were using was working quite well, and it really was just a tragedy, with, you know, for lack of a better word. But the media picked up on this, and the government picked up on this, and they were subsequently taken to court, charged with failing to provide the necessities for life, and they've really been embroiled in a legal battle ever since, making headline news. You know, but the framing behind it, I think, is what's important to relay here. And the framing behind it was that these folks, so David and his wife, essentially shunned all pharmaceuticals, all Western medicine, doctors, hospitals, etc. And they tried exclusively to treat their son's illness with natural medicine, and this is what caused him to die. And this is actually not the truth at all. And again, if you listen to the episode, we dive into a lot more of the background story and the sticking points and the actual truth, quite frankly. But the issue with all of this, and again, I encourage you to listen to this episode and get all the details, is that there are some precedents that are being pushed through into policy. And probably the most dangerous precedent that could potentially come from this is that if the government deems anything to be a necessity of life, quote unquote, and you fail to provide that, you could essentially be charged with your child's murder or death or manslaughter or whatever sort of level they decide to prosecute you at. What this means is that if you decide not to vaccinate and your child at the age of 12 or 13 or 14 dies from a disease that could have been prevented, I say that very loosely, by a vaccine, you could actually be charged with their death. This sets an extremely dangerous precedent that is heavily in favor of the medical establishment, of the pharmaceutical companies, and so on. And this is really the focal point of the conversation today. So take a listen to this episode. It was a very interesting episode to record. And it was a really great conversation with David. But as a parent, I just can't imagine the heartbreak. And, you know, David, you know, if you are listening to this, I did say this to you on the show, but David is a true warrior, someone who has taken this in stride and is remarkably grounded and centered and strong despite his experience and this tragedy. So listen to the episode. You know, definitely I want to hear your comments on this, because this is something that you perhaps have not heard of. So for those of you, you know, listening to this on Facebook or accessing this through there, I want to hear what you have to say in the comments. That would be really great. As always, if you do like the show, please consider sharing, subscribing, anything that you can do to help me get it out there. And of course, social media is a very powerful way to share this. So even if you are not overly interested in this particular episode, just know that a lot of your friends, family, people in your social network could very well be interested in what I'm sharing. Anyway, we'll leave it at that for today. And I bring you David Stefan. Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, Brett.
So, David, you know, we were talking a little bit off air, and we've definitely been moving in similar circles over the last, 10 years, maybe a little bit more, mutual contact, mutual friends, and so on. But this is really the first time that you and I are sitting down and having a conversation. So, really, really great to meet you. And I'm excited for our conversation tonight because I think that there are some very, very important questions and topics that have to be discussed in the current climate that we find ourselves in, and we'll work our way towards that. But, you know, let me just open things up and perhaps give me a little bit of background, because your family owns a supplement company called True Hope. But I found the backstory of how that actually came to be and your family's history is quite interesting. So perhaps you could just give us the sort of cliff notes and the trajectory on that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so my family didn't really know much about nutrition. You know, when I was a young boy, I remember my mother doing the odd Shaklee stuff. You know, we'd pop some alfalfa tablets or some vitamin C's that we were eating like candy because they were so sour. And then, you know, I still can remember the gritty taste of the protein shakes that they had back then. But that was about the depth of nutrition that we ever got into, and my mom was involved in it in the 80s. But in January of 1994, my mother, after having gone through a major roller coaster in life for about 10 years of high highs and low lows with the depression and mania that accompanied her bipolar disorder, She decided to go to the doctor, and she received a prescription for Prozac. And this is in January of 1994, and there wasn't a whole lot of information surrounding the risks of taking these SSRI medications. Well, 2 weeks after she began to take that medication, she ended up taking her own life. And it wasn't until about a decade later that we discovered that the pharmaceutical industry was well aware of all of the risks surrounding suicidal ideation increase when you took these SSRI medications, and they didn't release that to the public. And with Prozac in particular, in some instances, it was an increased risk of suicide by up to 12 times. And so,
wow.
Coming out of that, that left our whole family in absolute devastation. Now, she followed in the footsteps of her father, who had taken his life 15 years previous to that. And so these issues, many times being hereditary, and my mother and my father having 9 children, biological children, and then they adopted one more, making for a total of 10, all 9 of us had inherited their disorder in one way or another. And some of us in a much more significant way than others. And so there was 2 of my siblings that had it extremely bad, and my father exhausted everything that was available to him through the medical system. And eventually he was just given, when a head psychiatrist out of the Foothills Hospital in Calgary just was blunt and honest with him, he was given the idea that, first of all, this is as good as it will get. These medications, they're basically like a Band-Aid, and they're going to take away some of the symptoms, but they don't get rid of the condition itself. And so my brother, who is homicidal and suicidal and stockpiling weapons and basically the next schoolyard shooting waiting to happen, he had no hope of really having a meaningful life if he was actually going to have a long life at that. And so my father, after exhausting everything that the medical system had to offer and being given that idea that that's as good as it's going to get, and actually he needed to face the reality that someday he may have to plan more funerals, he began to look elsewhere, and he spent a lot of time in the community talking to people about what they knew about mental illness. Never did he get a good idea about remedies that could be used. He heard a lot of stories, but never once did he hear a story of recovery from somebody who had a severe mental health condition.
Well, especially back then, I mean, that was, now mental health is obviously quite a front and center topic, but back then was very much shrouded. I can only imagine not finding any clues, right?
Absolutely. And that was one of the problems is, these stories that he was hearing were stories that were normally kept in the closet because of the stigma around mental illness, the embarrassment factor. Mm. And so eventually in mid-1995, he just... realized that there wasn't a known answer to mental illness. And so he began to spend a lot of time in fasting and prayer, saying to himself, if there truly is a God, because he was always a believer in God, but he said, if there truly is a God, God wouldn't want his children to suffer like this, and God would know the answer. And so he spent a lot of time in fasting and prayer, and nothing miraculous happened overnight. But as he continued to do this, seeking out of desperation for healing for his family, because it was literally falling apart around him. My older sister was in and out of the psych wards. She's on a cocktail of 5 medications that weren't working at best. She was sedated. When she wasn't in the psych ward, she had to be on 24-hour supervision because she'd obsess about ways to kill herself and her 3-year-old son, thinking that it had to happen. She was completely delusional. And like I said, at best, she was sedated. And other times she was completely psychotic. And so my father was watching this happen. And so out of desperation, he sought the assistance of God. And as time went on over the next few months, bits and pieces of information came into his life. I remember as a young boy traveling down the road with him, he was a property manager over 26 large buildings in Southern Alberta. And sometimes I'd go with him traveling around a little bit. And I remember him putting these cassette tapes of Dead Doctors Don't Lie. And,
oh yeah! Well, you just flash back to the distant past there, but oh yeah, wow. Okay, I haven't heard that name for quite some time.
And for him it was enlightening. For me, it was traumatizing. Right? Like,
I can only imagine. And how old were you at the time?
Well, I would have been probably 11 or 12 at the time. So it wasn't my favorite thing to do. That's for sure. Though I'm sure without knowing it, I probably glean on that information now as I'm out educating people on the effectiveness of nutrient supplementation and how it can largely turn their lives right around from all of these different ailments. But back then I didn't see the value in it. So anyway, so stuff like that was coming into his life, and it ultimately prepared him for what he's going to hear in November of 1995, when as a property manager there, he was walking down the hallway talking with a colleague about replacing carpets, and he was overcome with this incredible impression to tell his colleague about what was happening at home and how if things didn't change, they'd have no choice but to institutionalize Joe, get him into the psych ward because everybody was fearing for their lives. And that's when the whole idea about this proper and powerful nutrition came into play and the effect that it have on mental illness, because his colleague said, you know, I don't have any mental illness in my family. They're all well, they're fine. I can't relate to you there. But I spent over 20 years in the animal feed industry formulating feed for hogs across Western Canada and the Western United States. And so his colleague, David Hardy, had been doing this and said, you know, we saw commonplace in the hog pens a condition called ear and tail biting syndrome, where the hogs had become irritable with each other, and they'd actually bite chunks of their ears and tails off each other. And if you didn't pen them away from each other, they'd actually kill each other.
Wow.
And so he said, we learned in the animal feed industry, you could completely eradicate that disorder simply by putting the proper nutrition into their feed. And that was like a light bulb moment for my dad, even though he'd already tried all sorts of other products, magnetic therapy, which is great, but didn't do it for Joseph. You know, what Joe still calls to this day rust water, and he was doing Tahitian noni juice, all these wonderful products. But nothing did it for Joe. But in that moment, he says like a light bulb flipped on. He knew it was the answer. They went down to a health food store, grabbed a bunch of different products. It didn't work, but they persisted with it. And within a few months, they'd come across a cocktail of properly processed nutrients and a proper broad spectrum array of them that had a significant effect. And within 5 days, it's like a light bulb turned on in Joseph. He could now see what was right and wrong. Within 30 days, he would have no longer been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And eventually one thing led to another, and we made an all-in-one product that's been significantly researched in multiple universities around the world, showing it to be more effective than your standard psychiatric medications on a large array of mental health conditions.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, just a few things that you touched on there, you know, the story of the hog farmer or the feed is very, very similar to Dr. Hoffer, right? Abram Hoffer, is that right? Have you heard of him? Yeah. I mean, very, very similar, you know, and I don't know whether that came before or after, but really just a sidebar to interject. But, you know, I've experienced this myself as a practitioner, where I've had people who have had a variety of different mental health issues. And I've always found that restoring balance from the ground up, you know, like root cause resolution, proper nutrition, cleansing and detoxification, like all these things, you know, I've never actually focused on mental health. It's never actually been, it's not what I'm known for. I've never focused on it yet. A lot of people I've noticed over the years have just said, wow, you know, I don't feel like that anymore. Or I feel more balanced or more grounded, or I can focus better. And I actually have used Empower Plus in my practice. I've referred a number of my clients onto you guys because I see the value of what you're doing. And I know that you have a lot of testimony behind that as well. So interesting story how all of that came about. And you work with the company right now, is that right?
I do, yeah. I run the Canadian division for it. We put it into health food stores and into various practitioners' offices. And we're being just really proactive that way to try to get people before they get to the point of being considered an extreme psychiatric patient, because that's what we had dealt with for many decades, was the medical system castaways is really what it would have been. From the late 90s up until just recent. And so now what we're trying to do is get people that are more proactive, that are feeling maybe a little bit anxious, a little bit depressed, and catching them before they end up going into that revolving door.
Yeah. So more preventative. Well, I mean, I think, you know, as much as I do, I know that you have staff on hand to help people sort of transition or wean off their pharmaceuticals and onto a more natural approach. But that's a really hard thing to get right. And I've tried a few times with clients and failed because it's, you know, once people have been on the psychotropics for, you know, 10, 15 years, it's really hard to get them off.
Yeah, it sure can be. It was a real great challenge for us, and it really took thousands of people, basically, in a sense, you know, for lack of better terms, being guinea pigs, where we were developing new protocols because it wasn't well known in the medical system how to withdraw patients from these medications. In fact, the doctors were being told that these medications weren't even addictive. They had something called discontinuation syndrome that was mild and transient. That's what they were being told back when we first started doing this. And we actually had to educate the researchers that first started using these protocols as they began to study the products, and they discovered that they had to withdraw the participants in the studies off of the medications. Otherwise, they become over-medicated while they're using the supplements. And they didn't know how to withdraw their participants off of that. We actually had to begin to train them, and they became enlightened as to how dangerously addictive these medications can be, because they weren't ever taught that either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you start getting into things like dopamine agonists and whatnot. I mean, you know, you're really messing around with your reward and pleasure centers, which of course is your addiction center as well. So, but you know, okay, so I'm going to shift gears a little bit and perhaps throw a bit of a curveball here, because for our listeners listening to this, this sounds like, you know, a real sort of hero's tale. Everything's worked out great, but where you're at right now, and I'll keep this on point here with True Hope, this whole trajectory didn't happen very easily, right? From what I understand. I mean, there was, you definitely had your run-ins with Health Canada. There was a lot of pushback. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about that as well, and the sort of adversity that you faced on the journey so far.
Absolutely. So my dad decided to get this, him and his colleague, David Hardy, decided to get this product studied so that it could get into the hands of doctors. Really altruistic motives there, with my father, you know, his family being blessed by this and whatnot. So they thought that the easiest and best thing to do would be to go and get it researched, and that the medical community would just readily accept it because of its merits. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case at all. After the first study came out and it showed itself, it showed that these supplements were over 3 times more effective than your standard antidepressants. It caught a lot of attention, went on to national news, and the very next day Health Canada swooped in. They shut down any further studies that were taking place because there was a double-blind placebo-controlled trial taking place that was being funded to the tune of over $500,000 by the Alberta government, because the Alberta government recognized the benefits of this and wanted to get this into the medical system, because it would not only save on healthcare costs in the interim, but in the long term, it was returning people back to living productive lives so that they could actually become contributing members of society. So there's a double benefit for the government there, tax revenue as well. But anyway, so Health Canada came in, they shut down all the studies, and they tried to prevent this from moving forward into Canada. And my father, kind of being naive in a sense, thinking that maybe they're just a little bit misled or whatnot. Maybe I can work with them and you know, we can work things out. He discovered that they had an agenda. And at one point, after he was trying to work with them to get a drug identification number, because that's what they said that he needed in order to help somebody with bipolar, even though it was only a multivitamin mineral supplement.
And that, of course, has changed now as well. I mean, now we have NPN numbers versus DIN numbers for pharmaceuticals and natural health products.
That's right. So as of January 2004, that all changed. Whereas prior to that, in October of 2000 was when this conflict really started. It was a different scenario. So if you had a natural health product that had a therapeutic effect in certain diseases like bipolar, then it was no longer a natural health product. It was now a drug based on what it was able to do.
And so if you needed a drug identification number, does that mean that you have to go through pharmaceutical scale, like clinical trials and all that sort of stuff, like proof of efficacy and whatnot?
That's right. So the irony here is that Health Canada came in and shut down that double blind placebo controlled trial that would have been necessary to get that drug identification number. So Health Canada was preventing us from moving forward to be able to get what they demanded that we needed. And so at one point they actually said, you know, if you want to continue doing this, Mr. Stefan, perhaps you just want to move south of the border, as if Canadians weren't deserving of a Canadian discovery, right? And so at that point, my father just said, you know, I don't need the permission of some bureaucrat in Ottawa to tell me whether or not I can bless the lives of other families like my family's been blessed. So he started to just outright ignore them. And they didn't take lightly to that. And eventually it came to a head in early 2003 when Health Canada shut it down at the border because we were having it manufactured in the States. They shut it down at the border, prevented over 3,000 Canadians from having access to it, created a crisis that they were well aware that they were going to create, put people in harm's way. And they were actually warned at one point by Ron Lajeunesse, the head of the Canadian Mental Health Association's Alberta chapter, that Ron Lajeunesse was aware of people that were contemplating suicide because of what Health Canada was doing, and they no longer had access to their treatment of choice. But Health Canada ignored those warnings, and as a result, there was suicides that took place because of their actions.
And do you feel, I mean, so just to sort of sum that up for our listeners here, you know, people have this natural health product, it's working for them, everyone's doing great, we're all on track, the government's supporting it, and we're moving forward, and you've got Health Canada just completely derailing the whole situation, and not just derailing the situation and stopping a company from operating, but actually also causing people or patients taking these products to now commit suicide and, of course, relapse into their previous state of mental health, right? But what can I ask you, what do you think the agenda was? I mean, is this just straight up like we don't like natural health products and you're infringing on pharmaceuticals, or what do you, did they tell you what it was?
Well, you know, I can give you my opinion, but it's
sure.
That's the opinion of one man. What I will give you beyond that, because I think everybody would know what my opinion on the matter is and my take on the pharmaceutical corruption. But when we take a look at the FOIP request that we received from Health Canada, we see a few names on there of individuals by the name of Dr. Terry Polvoy and Marvin Ross, who is a journalist who's done many jobs for the pharmaceutical industry. And at this time, they were actually running a major campaign against us, and they had incited this action. They'd worked as consultants for Health Canada to incite this action against us and prevent this product from being available to those 3,000 Canadians. Now, at the same time, Marvin Ross was working very closely, I think he still does, with the Ontario Schizophrenic Society. And he had done an anti-True Hope meeting at one point that my father became aware of, and my father flew out just to sit there present in the audience. And when Marvin Ross was introduced, Janssen Lilly, the pharmaceutical company, was accredited for putting up Marvin Ross with his accommodations and making this possible. So when we see attachments like that taking place with the pharmaceutical industry, with those that are working to take this work down through Health Canada, I can't help but say this is a pharmaceutically driven agenda. Absolutely. I mean, the evidence is all there. You got people that are backed by the pharmaceutical industry to do what they're doing, to run things like Quackwatch and Health Watcher here in Canada, and they are the ones that are listed on the Health Canada file as being complicit in making this happen.
Right. So you're not the only people. I'm not going to get into that on this particular episode, but you're not the first person who's told me that. And I think that more and more people are actually waking up to the fact that this is not simply conspiracy theory and tinfoil hats and whatever else. It's not that anymore. I mean, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, we could have said that because the evidence wasn't there. But there's more and more and more of this evidence really coming to light. Now, in the current moment right now, obviously all of that is aside, you know, True Hope operates unabated, like you guys are all good at the moment. NPN numbers and all that. Yeah. Okay.
We were licensed and we're moving forward. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So that's great. But you recently, and we're going to shift gears entirely now and sort of leave the company behind, because the other main reason why I wanted to get you on the show, which is a little tragic. And, you know, you found yourself a few years ago, you know, headline news, the real sort of poster people, if you will, because it was you and your wife, you know, just got slammed in the media for only choosing natural medicine, et cetera, et cetera. But I just want to let you tell that story. You know exactly what I'm talking about, obviously. Yeah. I just want to let you tell the story in your own words, and then let's really look at what happened since then and where we find ourselves in the current climate.
Absolutely. How much time do you have?
we're good. I mean, we can keep going for another half hour, 40 minutes. We're not okay. In any rush. Yeah.
Perfect. Because I generally find myself telling the story in light of all of the misinformation that the media has put out there. And it generally will take me about a half an hour to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'll tell it in a Coles Note version without addressing what the media has had to say.
Sure.
And hopefully for those who are listening, they're not followers of the media, or they take it all with a grain of salt, because I mean, I knew that the media was corrupt prior to this, and that it wasn't always truthful. They were sensationalizing things, but I had no idea to what extent until I found myself on the front page of the news internationally, and realized how off they get things, and how it seems to be intentional, where they omit a lot of information to create to move an agenda. So I'm not going to address all of the mistruths of the media, but. So our child back in 2012, our son Ezekiel, 18 months old, beautiful little boy, smart, healthy, nothing of concern. He ended up coming down with what appeared to be the croup, and it appeared to be a typical croup. And prior to this, you know, he'd been sick off and on the odd time, but nothing like what a lot of the neighborhood kids would get. And that's, I would say, largely due to how proactive we are with nutrition in our home. And so he'd get smoothies on a daily basis, whether he is sick or not. And so would his older brother, and they'd rarely ever get sick. And so anyways, he came down with what appeared to be the croup. And this time it almost appeared to be a typical croup that a child would get. And it maintained for about 5 days. And then he overcame it. He was in recovery mode. He went back to church, back to preschool with his older brother, parent preschool, and the following week. And then he started to come down with what seemed like the early onset symptoms of the flu. And so I had come off a business trip about Thursday, took a look at him, and I said, yeah, it looks like the flu. But he's got no, he wasn't vomiting. There was no fever. There was nothing of alarm that would have alarmed any parent at that point. And so this is a Thursday, and he ended up passing on the next Tuesday. So we're talking 5 days here. We ended up using some treatments that the media has definitely sensationalized. We used them twice, to my recollection, maybe three times. But it was a tincture that you could make out of horseradish root, onion, garlic, ginger, and you blend it up. And so when we said that we blended it up, they called it a smoothie, that we made the smoothie for them. But then you take that and you let it sit overnight, and then you strain it out and you can make a tincture out of it. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't want to take the time to strain it, so we gave him like a little spoonful, and we did so about two or three times. But we were also giving him other stuff like MSM and olive leaf extract was actually the main one that we were giving him. And olive leaf extract is actually well documented in science for being a great antifungal, antibacterial.
Anti-everything. I mean, antiviral properties. Yeah, the whole thing.
Yeah, anti-parasitic. And so it's just a great, great product. In fact, one of the studies I saw published, I think it was in April 2012, the concluding statement was that it should be used in place of other antibiotics for its profound effect on multiple strains of bacteria and its profound effect in eliminating them. And so we were using that, and you know, but there was nothing of alarm. There was nothing that would have told any parent, hey, you know, take them into the hospital. So we actually stopped using a lot of these things by late Friday or early Saturday, because his symptoms had subsided to the point that we just didn't see any necessity in giving them to him. And so Saturday rolls around, Sunday rolls around. He seems to be, you know, recovering, nothing of concern. But then I go to a town hall meeting on the Monday. Now, my family isn't only known for putting together natural health products and fighting off Health Canada in the courts and winning. We're also known as a bunch of health freedom advocates. Mm-hmm. On all sorts of topics. And yes. So,
well, that's, you know, actually how I've met your dad and some of the other folks that we spoke about off air. So yeah, was through health freedom.
Right. Yeah. And so we headed up the Bill C-51 movement back in, I think it was 2008, with the Stop C-51 signs. Yeah. And all that. Yeah. When we discovered what was going on, at the same time put up a website called Health Canada Exposed, showing what they were actually up to and under the guise of consumer protection. And so anyways, so we found out about, on a local level, this law that had been pushed down by the Alberta government. And what it did is it removed your rights in the state of an emergency. And when I say it removed your rights, it removed all of your rights except your right to life. That was it. But they could conscript you. They could send you off to a labor camp. They could do whatever they wanted to. Your property is theirs. at the end of the emergency, you get it all back, but you get no compensation for the use and the wear and tear on whatever it may have been that they used, whether it was your house or your tractor or whatever it may be. So you lose all rights, and there is no clear definition as to what an emergency was. So we see this law and we say, wait a minute. First of all, we don't need government intervention saying what's best for us here. When a crisis happens, it's always the community that binds together, and they get the job done out of the goodness of their hearts. Even if someone else isn't suffering, they see their neighbor suffering, and they put on their boots and they get to work, right? And so we're like, we don't need the government intervention coming in and saying, you know, this is how we're going to do it, and we're doing it. We see how disastrous that can be. So we went and fought it. And so I was presenting at that meeting on the Monday. So I made sure that I slept in a spare bedroom that we had downstairs so that I didn't disturb anybody at night. And I woke up and I was out of there before anybody got up. Well, I get home at about noon and we successfully had it thrown out and it went on the news. And the Alberta government became aware of it, that we had just done this on a municipal level. And they understood that we are now going to come up to the legislator level on this and fight this law. And so we're excited about this. But when I get home, my wife is 4.5 months pregnant and she's visibly distraught. And I guess what happened is that Ezekiel had reverted back to where he was on the Thursday. He had had a restless night. She was sleep deprived, 4.5 months pregnant, hormonal. And now she's like, you know, what do we do about this? He just reverted back. And so I went and took a look at him. And I thought, well, you know, there's, you know, if we were taken to the doctor, it wouldn't, you know, do anything. Like, he just seems tired and he's content, you know, watching his cartoons, his backyardigans. And so she decided, well, that's not enough. I'm going to call Terry, my midwife, who's also a nurse. And,
right. I think that's also clear to point out. It's a good thing to point out.
Yeah, she's an emergency room nurse and had been so for the previous 9 years and was still practicing as an emergency room nurse. And so my wife was due for a checkup anyways in regard to her pregnancy. And so just thought, you know, have her come and check on me, see how everything's going, and also check up on Ezekiel and give us an opinion as to whether or not we take him to the doctor. And so that was really the sole purpose of having her come out on that specific day. So I had another meeting to go to at True Hopes. I did. And I get back from the meeting and my wife briefs me on what had transpired when Terry had come over. And so Terry, the midwife or emergency room nurse, comes over and she ends up looking at my son Ezekiel, and she ends up, you know, getting out the stethoscope and you know, takes his pulse and all that type of stuff. And what she found was completely normal. Everything was normal. Breathing was normal. Heart rate was normal. Blood pressure normal. All of his vitals came back normal. So nothing of concern. You know, she noted that there was, you know, no snotty nose. There was nothing like that. There's nothing visibly alarming that would have alarmed anybody. Just like I had thought previous as well when I'd given my wife my opinion. And so what she stated to my wife is if you were to take him into the doctor, you'd likely be turned away based on the lack of symptoms. Huh. But what she did add to that, and this is where it became troublesome later on, is because Terry, as an emergency room nurse, had come across a case of meningitis about 2 weeks prior, before she had even come out to see our son Ezekiel and he had even seen him, she already had this running through her mind that, you know, maybe, you know, who knows, maybe it's meningitis, maybe it's going around. And so she made note of that and told my wife, saying, you know, you might want to look into meningitis because I had this case pop up in the emergency room about 2 weeks ago. So my wife did, along with her, and anybody who has the symptoms of the flu will also have a lot of the symptoms of viral meningitis, especially.
Especially in the early stages.
Exactly. And so that was now on the radar that there's a potential, it's viral meningitis. Viral meningitis isn't really lethal. In fact, we weren't aware of how non-lethal it was, but the former chief medical examiner of Alberta ended up testifying in our case and stated that it's virtually nobody dies from it. That in all of her years as a forensic pathologist, she's never seen anybody come into the medical examiner's office who had died from viral meningitis. It just doesn't happen. And so It can't be treated with antibiotics, and it's a lot less severe than bacterial meningitis. And
so can I ask you, just to interject for a second? So what do you do then? I mean, viral meningitis, you just let it run its course. Is that what you were told?
Basically, even online, that's what it had stated, is that because antibiotics don't work for it, unless something like severe happens, and you take somebody into the hospital for it. That was the information that we had gotten online. That's what my wife had briefed me on. Now, my wife, a few hours previous, before I went to the meeting, was distraught. So if there had been any inclination to take him into the doctor, I would have been getting home, and I would have been driving my 4-year-old and my 18-month-old and my wife into the doctor for a visit, based on our previous conversation. So that wasn't what came up at all. And in fact, so now viral meningitis is on the radar. And so we had a discussion that night. We said, well, okay, if anything turns to the worst, then we'll take him into the doctor in case it is viral meningitis. And so that's what we ended up doing. We ended up putting him back onto the herbal treatments that he had been on about 3 or 4 days previous. And he ended up responding. He had a really good sleep on the Monday night. Tuesday, we wake up, and we had to go sign papers at the lawyers. And we ended up taking him into Lethbridge. And we made a mistake here, looking back in hindsight, because it's been exploited so severely. And what it was is we put him into the car seat. And at that point, he hadn't transitioned over to the front-facing toddler car seat. Mm. He was still in the infant car seat. So he was on the big side of it. And on a good day, he was uncomfortable in it. And so when we put him in there, he didn't look very comfortable at all, and we didn't want to compromise the progress that had been made in the last 12 or so hours. And so we decided to put him onto a memory foam topper in the back of the vehicle to allow him to be mobile and to continue on with his progress of healing. And he did. He continued on, but unfortunately, the media has played this out to be he was stiff as a board, that he couldn't even fit into the car seat. And so they've exploited that. And even a child with bacterial meningitis, they don't get stiff as a board like that. They don't respond like an adult. So scientifically, it's not even a sound statement that they're making, but it is so sensational and gets people so irate that they're blinded to all the facts that come forward after that.
Well, because you just pull that out, and all of a sudden it screams negligence, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the end of the story, you know, closed case kind of thing.
Exactly. And the irony here is that when we get into the courts, the judge actually broke down at one point and almost started to cry when he made mention that this is a unique case, because you know, all the evidence that's before the courts is that the Steffens are caring, they're loving, and they're attentive, not negligent. And so that's the evidence that came before the courts. And so but that they've tried to make it look like we're extremely negligent parents, which would get anybody irate, and that we just basically left him to die, and he deteriorated over 2 weeks, being sick in bed for those weeks and just getting worse and worse and worse to the point that he just died. That's how they've tried to make this out to be, and yet here you've got these low-lying symptoms of what appears to be the flu, no fever, no vomiting, and anyway, so I guess I should go into what caused his arrest, or, well, we don't even know what caused his arrest. His cardiac arrest or respiratory arrest, and I'm not sure how it panned out. But so we take him to Lethbridge that day, and by the time that we were leaving Lethbridge, he was almost what I'd call symptom free. Like, there was nothing visible that you could tell that he was even, you know, ill in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I fell asleep beside him, lying in the back with him, and he ended up waking me up at one point, sitting there playing with my lip. I'm flipping it because we do that sometimes, and you make a noise while you do it. And so it doesn't sound like a child who has been deteriorating for 2 weeks and is about to die, 6 hours later. So we get him home, and he ends up going down for an incredible nap. Right before he goes down, he drinks about a cup of electrolyte drink on his own, which also goes against the media saying that we had to feed him through an eyedropper. I don't even know how you feed somebody through an eyedropper.
Yeah, seriously.
even a turkey baster, I don't know how you could feed somebody through that. You can't get substance through that, really. So he goes down, and he has this beautiful nap, and he wakes up with this breathing pattern a few hours later. And before my wife and I had an opportunity to really assess it, he ended up stopping breathing. And we didn't know what had taken place, if he had aspirated on liquid that we'd given him or what it was. We had no clue. And it caught us completely off guard, because here he had gone without symptoms for the better part of a day. And now all of a sudden, there's something new altogether that doesn't correlate with what's been happening the past few days. The flu symptoms are gone. Everything else is gone. And all of a sudden, he's got this breathing pattern and he stops breathing. So I run out on the phone with 911 to give him our rural address, as we live about 25 minutes from the nearest hospital. And I come back in and he's breathing again. And it turns out that my wife gave him a rescue breath, patted him on the back. He coughed up mucus and fluid and he was breathing. And so I'm like, oh my goodness, I just phoned 911 for no reason. Sorry, no issues here, type of thing. Like, yeah, he was sick, but he's not now. And all of a sudden he had the breathing pattern. He coughs up mucus and fluid and he's breathing. So, you know, we're now in an extreme state of confusion. Is this an emergency? Is it not an emergency?
Yeah.
And so anyways, I guess protocol is, when you phone 911, and a child has stopped breathing, they dispatch the ambulance regardless, so that they can come and check even the oxygen levels and just ensure that the child's okay. Well, in this case, they didn't do that. I'm a confused parent. I've never phoned 911 before. I'm not familiar with emergency protocols. And so we just say, well, okay, I guess we should maybe just take him into the hospital, right? And so we decided to do that. And so we get our 4-year-old son, we wake him up, and we get our 18-month-old son, and we get them into the vehicle, and we start driving. And we're driving down a bumpy gravel road, as we live out in the country. And a mile into our drive, our 18-month-old stops breathing again. And he goes into the same situation that he was before. And so my wife commences to give him CPR, and I phone 911. And hand the phone over to her. They instruct her on how to give proper CPR, as protocols have changed over the years, and it's different for an 18-month-old. And they ask her at one point if the air is going into his lungs, and she says, "Well, no, it's passing through some kind of fluid. Like there seems to be some kind of gargling." So here he's got this throat obstruction, probably similar in nature to the mucus and fluid that he'd coughed up previous to him breathing the last time. And so we continued driving, and they dispatched the wrong ambulance, first of all. And we ended up driving within 100 yards of where this rural ambulance was outfitted and ready to go. And we drove almost all the way to Cardston, which was generally about a 25-minute drive, but it was only 11 minutes into our drive based on the speed that we were driving. And we met the ambulance probably about 4 or 5 kilometers outside of, probably 6 kilometers outside of Cardston. And they took over the care of Ezekiel. And we get to the hospital about 10 minutes later, and he's lifeless. He's basically brain dead for the most part, is what it appears. No response. And subsequently, he gets shipped off, airlifted to Alberta Children's Hospital, where we're told that he likely won't make it through the night. We end up beating, we had to drive north, 2.5 hours to Calgary, and we actually beat them there by about an hour. And wow. We're wondering why it took so long. Well, we kind of know why it took so long, but there's about what appears to be about 100 pages of medical evidence, medical files that are missing during his transport. That would probably paint a much clearer picture as to what took place now. But we get there and we're told that he's basically not going to make it through the night, because he'd gone for about 40 minutes during transport in cardiac arrest, and that they couldn't get his heart going. And we thought, well, what the heck? Like, he was stabilized when he was in Cardston. His heart was going and everything. So what happened during transport that would do this? And they further told us that he was in what they call medically induced coma. And so we weren't aware that during the transport, first of all, the first ambulance he made it into was ill-equipped for about a year previous. The paramedics have been making requests for the equipment. Alberta Health Services had ignored those requests. And it wasn't until our son got into that ambulance and they couldn't get an airway into him for over 8 minutes that they decided to honor those requests the following week. And those ambulances were outfitted with the proper equipment for a toddler to get an airway. Second to that, during transport, they ended up giving him a medication called rocuronium, which, given his circumstances and all the other things that he was on, was contraindicated. And he ended up going into cardiac arrest prior to getting into Lethbridge, where they were then going to airlift him over to Calgary. And then they gave him 3 more doses of that medication, which I'm not sure if that's what they considered putting him into the medically induced coma. But it was something that he never came out of. And the reason why they gave him that medication is because he had started to move, and they were concerned that he was actually going to pull his breathing tube out. And so here he wasn't actually dead, like the media says that he was, that he was actually dead before he got to the ambulance, and that they had done all that they could. So even though the ambulance was ill-equipped, it didn't make a difference because he was dead. Well, it turns out that he wasn't, even after going 8 minutes without oxygen, and they actually had to use massive amounts of medication on him to prevent him from pulling out his breathing tube. And then by the time that we saw him, he was once again completely lifeless and never came out of it.
Wow. Just so heartbreaking, you know, and just what a crazy story. And I know, I mean, I've read so many of the media reports, and I thank you for being here and for sharing your story, because I know how hard it is for you to be able to share these things in detail through the media. You know, it's like you don't have a platform like that, right? And I know that you have been gaining a lot of traction. I know you've been getting your story out there. So, you know, I'm just truly sorry for what you had to go through. And thank you for sharing so openly what that looked like. So you get charged, you go to courts, this gets dragged through the courts, and what happens, you know, because I don't want to dissect the court case too much and all of that. We'll be here for a really long time. So what happened at the end of all of that? I mean, the media obviously just smeared you like 100%.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And they still to some degree are, but what manifested from that?
Well, there was two things that manifested from it in regard to a new precedent in Canada being set that should be alarming to every Canadian. But before I get there, I'll make the statement that if every Canadian knew what happened in that courtroom, there'd be a major public outcry. There would. Because even those that were in the courtroom and saw what was happening, whether they knew us or they didn't, they were all saying the same thing. Holy crap, this could have been us. This could have been us. Mm-hmm. Because what it came down to is that we didn't get charged in the death of our son, but rather for endangering his life, because it was proven that the ambulance issue was what caused his death, and that there's no way they could have got the jury to side with the Crown in being charged for the conviction of his death, or convicted for his death, even though the media says otherwise.
And so I just want to say something, because you know what, and really I'm just going to back up a little bit and give us the 1,000-foot overview here for those who are just listening to this this whole story for the first time. Essentially, what transpired in the media, from what I can see as an outsider reading the media, was basically that you and your wife were 100% only natural. You basically shunned pharmaceuticals, shunned doctors, medical care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And a large part of why your son died was basically because you wouldn't accept medical intervention and you tried to treat him naturally.
And he deteriorated over 2 weeks to the point that he died because of our beliefs. That's exactly what they've tried to lay out.
Yeah, and that's what I've read. You know, I think that's still floating around out there for the most part. But this is actually, obviously, we now know that that's just really not the case. And so in the courts, you were charged with endangering his life.
Well, we were charged with failing to provide the necessaries of life.
Right, that's right. That's right.
Now here's the interesting thing, is that the RCMP who came and investigated it, the Child Protective Services that came and investigated it, even one of the doctors who was called in as an abuse expert, none of them had any recommendations for charges. They didn't see any criminal behavior in what we had done. And so it was really interesting to us when almost a year after his passing, shortly after this autopsy report comes out that's been proven false, like proven completely false. In fact, they withheld evidence, any evidence that went against the autopsy report, they withheld showing that the autopsy report was a complete fabrication in order for a vaccine precedent is where they're going with it.
And we'll get back to that.
Yeah, so it's really interesting when they came and charged us after we thought the case was closed, and the officers involved, everybody involved that was firsthand involved, aside from some of the doctors, other doctors out of the Alberta Children's Hospital, they didn't see any need for charges. And so it just seemed really interesting when that came in almost a year after. We get charged with failing to provide necessaries of life. Now, there's two things to that. When somebody, traditionally, in case law, when somebody's charged with failing to provide the necessaries of life and a death is involved, causation of death comes into play, where you have to prove the causation of death, and it has to fall on the hands of those that are being charged, right?
Logically, well, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is that you've got this ambulance that was ill-equipped, and they knew it was ill-equipped, and our son ends up in it, and he dies because of oxygen deprivation for over 8 minutes, and yet nobody's charged there. And so they had to go against case law on the matter and make it so that it was about endangering his life. So now we're not saying that they caused his death. In fact, the Crown Prosecution even came out and said this right to the media firsthand, where they said, we're not saying that he caused his death, or Judge Jerky didn't find that they had caused his death, because they were trying to clear up all of the misinformation that the media was reporting, but the media tried to ignore that as much as possible. And so that was the first issue. The second issue is that there was a new precedent set in regard to what a necessity was or a necessary.
So this happened before this or around the same time?
No,
or
this is happening in our court case. So our court case has established two new precedences. Two new precedents. And what it is one, that now somebody can be charged, even though that they didn't cause the death, they can be charged for endangering. So let's say that you have another parent who ends up in the medical system, and the medical system fails miserably, but yet the parent maybe didn't act quite quick enough, or it's subjective. They can be the ones that are being charged, not the medical system, and they can be charged for endangering their life that led up to the failure of providing of the necessaries of life. So it's a double standard, right? And so that's problematic. So now one party doesn't get held accountable for what they've done, but yet the other party does. So parents are being held to a higher standard than medical professionals.
And I think you hit the nail right on the head there. You know, wow. Okay, so parents are being held to a higher standard than medical professionals. And I'm going to just add one point, because I think that this is what's going on as well, is the medical establishment, for lack of a better word, whether it's doctors, whether it's whatever, the responsibility is now not on their shoulders anymore for the well-known side effects and complications of multiple medications, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a fair thing to say as well.
Absolutely. In fact, the second precedent that was established here kind of goes in line with that. And what it was is, when you determine what a necessary is, you have to, or if you say that, okay, if a parent is charged with failing to provide the necessaries of life, it has to be determined what was necessary and what was it that they had failed to provide that was necessary. So in our court case, what happened throughout the entirety of it was that never at one point was it determined that had we brought Ezekiel into the doctor, that it would have actually changed the outcome. Because they wouldn't have known how to deal with the symptoms. They wouldn't have known whether or not to admit the child based on the low-lying symptoms, you know, all of that. So never at one point was it determined that had we brought Ezekiel into the doctor or into the hospital, that it would have actually changed the outcome of anything. So how would that be necessary then? If you can't determine that it's going to change the outcome, then it can't be, right?
Well, this is essentially core to the whole situation here, the whole case, because I mean, from where I'm sitting, if there was no difference, then you all had the same tools to deal with the same situation, you all had the same knowledge, you all had the same take on what was actually going on at the time, and that's that, you know. So it could have, the coin could have fallen either way, which sort of takes the onus off you
in a sense. So they couldn't determine that it was necessary because they couldn't identify at what time, you know, if he was brought in, would have it saved his life? Well, we don't know. And so based on that, the judge had to make a concession, where the case law on these matters states when you instruct the jury that basically it'd be something like this, you know, the Stephens endangered Ezekiel's life at a time where medical attention would have made a difference, right? So that would have.
Right.
Now, what the judge did is he reworded it going against all previous case law to state that they endangered his life at a time that medical attention could, not would, have made a difference.
Hmm.
So now it becomes completely ambiguous, where it's like, well, it could have made a difference. We don't know.
But
we
it
don't
could need also to provide not evidence. Have.
Exactly, right? So Now imagine this. So initially they were trying to get us on a vaccine precedent, and how we combated that to the point where they ran away from that one because it was a landmine for them to step on with the evidence that we had showing that the vaccines weren't safe or effective. And they would have done the opposite in the courtroom as to what they were hoping to get. And so what this precedent does, though, let's say that I choose not to vaccinate as a parent. And let's say that my child comes down with something that they deem to be vaccine preventable.
Mm.
Well, now I go to fight that in court because they charge me for it, for failing to provide the necessaries of life because the vaccine could have made a difference. And so it doesn't matter really what evidence I bring forward to the contrary, saying that, you know, in all these situations, it didn't make a difference. In these situations, it actually caused death. In these situations, it caused neurological impairment, right? It doesn't matter. I can bring all of that forward, but if it still could have made a difference.
Which, to be fair, I mean, I think we both sit on the same side of the fence with the vaccine debate. We're not going to go there in depth today. But it might have, it could have, but there's also a huge body of evidence to show that there could also have been adverse reactions to the vaccine. So It's sort of, you know, we just expected to roll the dice now, and if it doesn't work out in our favor, we get charged.
That's what it seems like.
That is what it seems like to me from what you're telling me. Is this something, you know, again, we spoke about this off air. Do you think that this is something that is becoming very front and center? Like, could this actually become a reality in Canada right now? I mean, I know that they're pushing for mandatory vaccinations and all sorts of stuff, but do you feel like your case is really a precedent to open that door and they're actually actively trying to drive it home?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when we ended up in the preliminary trial in June 2014, that's what came forward very clear and concise when the Crown prosecution was the medical examiner, and he started going off on a tangent about vaccines and asking this and that and how it would have prevented this. Hmm. And my lawyer stood up and said, you know, just so that we don't go off on a tangent here, I wasn't aware that vaccines were going to be a part of this trial. And the Crown prosecution fired back and said, oh, actually, they're going to be a big part of this trial. And so my lawyer fired back and said, well, just for the record, this is going to be a long trial because now we're going to be contesting the merits of vaccines. And the Crown prosecution fired back and said, okay. Well, at lunch break, they went and had a sit down, the Crown prosecution and my lawyer, to see what's going on here. And the Crown prosecution vocalized to my lawyer saying that what they're looking to do was set a new precedent in Canada that if you as a parent chose not to vaccinate and something happened to your child that they deemed to be vaccine preventable, that the parents would be held criminally liable for it. So that's where they were coming from the outset.
And this was 2014, you say?
This is 2014. So what I did in 2015 is I went and met with Dr. Tony Bark and Tetjan Opakanich and a bunch of other, I met with Andrew Wakefield. I went and met with a lot of these individuals. And we put together a team that consisted of Dr. Tony Bark, who produced the documentary Bot, and Tetjan Opakanich, and then Etta West out of with Vaccine Choice Canada. And that's where we came up with a lot of the evidence that showed that the vaccine that they said could have saved his life, even though it was a fabricated result that they got for the autopsy. But even if he had that, we showed that the vaccine they're recommending was neither safe or effective. And we had this body of evidence that was about to come forward to the courts. And I was actually looking forward to it because it would have solidified a better precedent the other way if they failed with us, because we knew if they're going to do it to us, they're going to do it to somebody else.
Of course. Especially in the current climate where people are becoming more tuned in and more educated about that and are making informed choices. And a lot of people are opting out of vaccines. So, yes. Yeah.
And currently in Canada, the Constitution makes it so that they can't mandate vaccines. So it's a beautiful thing. So what's the next best way? Scare the heck out of parents saying, hey, you can end up just like the Steffens. You're going to go to jail because you chose not to vaccinate, right? So so kind of coercion through fear of criminal prosecution.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're doing that now as well with the whole vaccine school, quote unquote. I don't even think it's a school, but the government is now saying if you choose not to vaccinate, then you have to go to the school where they're going to show you, whatever that means, why you should vaccinate. And who knows, maybe your case will come up, would come up in that school.
It very likely could. And it was even used by the local medical system within our area to tote vaccines right from the get-go, before anybody even knew what my son had passed from, before the autopsy report was even completed. There was already public health nurses in our area that were using our situation as a prime example when they were going around to these new parents saying, well, did you hear about that case? You're going to want to vaccinate.
Wow. So, I mean, you know, it's very concerning for a number of reasons. And I guess, you know, I don't want to take up too much more of your time today. I wanted to just, like, let's take a little glimpse into the future, because, you know, we've touched on vaccines and this whole precedent. Do you feel like this could potentially open the door to other precedents? And I'm just going to say this very, very loosely and off the cuff, where the medical system and government and Health Canada, whoever else, wants to have more and more control over our rights and freedoms?
I'll say this. Our court case was made out to be the perfect court case to usher in medical tyranny. On all levels, vaccines aside, all other elements as well. It can be used in any area of medical prosecution.
Right, because again, if there was something that could have prevented and could have, is so ambiguous that you could just sort of throw whatever you want at that. And
chemotherapy for a child, whatever it may be, regardless of the risks, absolutely. It removes all those rights.
And of course, because now we have this, you know, all of the medical journals and the 100 years of where we find, you know, the history of medicine. Of course, the thing that anyone throws back at me usually, and I'm sure you get it all the time, is look at the science, right? Look at the science. And so it's always going back to these medical journals and saying, well, look, this is what we have that's published. And so there's the proof that it could have worked, right? Yep. When in actual fact, and I'm just going to say this, is the editor of The Lancet, the editor of, I believe, the British Medical Journal, have both come out and said that 50% of the information in their journals are in fact false. So there's a large body of counter science and counter evidence that has not been published and that has been blatantly suppressed by pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, et cetera. So we find ourselves in a very, very dangerous and sort of uncharted territory, I believe, which is quite concerning.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it comes down to one thing. It's the fact that people in droves are moving away from the allopathic model because of all of the issues that they encounter there, all the side effects and the complications, and the fact that, you know, it's been listed as the third leading cause of death in North America, which is largely underreported. I mean, when you take a look at
it's never reported.
And those that are reported, we have a number of over 300,000 people that die annually within North America from medical misadventure. And then we have on top of that, another over 100,000 that die in North America from properly prescribed medications. So when we take a look at that and people are running from that, the industry is becoming desperate. And so now they're, through alternative means, they're trying to coerce people into buying their wares, whereas people don't want to.
Through fear, obviously. You know, what's funny is I was reading one article about, I think it was about Empower Plus, or I'm pretty sure, or True Hope. And I think the article stated that in your existence, so the existence of the company, there'd been 14 reports of adverse reactions you know, quote unquote, whatever those were. They didn't really elaborate. And I thought, and I chuckled because I know the figures, right? I mean, it's like 106,000 people every year just in the US having these deaths, not even just adverse reactions. And so, yeah, so I just thought to myself, wow, man, like, how do you, like, if you didn't know the other side, 14 might look pretty bad, you know, but if if you waited against 106,000 every year, it's like, okay, hang on, what's what?
And, so, and what they fail to tell you is that with those 14 cases is what other medications were those individuals on that they're withdrawing from at that time.
Exactly. Right? Which brings us full circle back to the beginning of this episode where we spoke about that. So, David, I'm going to wrap this up, but, you know, thank you just so much for coming on the show and for, you know, it's been a great conversation. You know, thank you for being so candid and open and honest. And, you know, is there anything else you want to sort of share with us before you leave? I mean, giving you the platform, giving you the mic, and of course, also let us know, you know, if where our people can find you, if there's anything we can support you with or anything like that, please let us know.
Lovely. Well, I appreciate that, Brett. Yeah, you know, I guess I always love to end off with a message of love, but before doing so, I'll answer your question about where people can find me. You can generally find me online there on Facebook. That's where we do a lot of our posting as to what's going on. Supporting, it really comes down to, in general, supporting freedom across the country, taking a stand. And that's really where my message of love comes in. Because throughout all this, I've recognized that love is definitely the most powerful force. And that it's what keeps us afloat through the hardest times. And so there's been so many times I've been tempted to give into the bitterness and the hatred, when you see the false accusations being made, when you see, you know, internationally your name's being strewn and you're getting hate messages from a bunch of countries around the world, it's so easy to give into that and become a part of the hate and to just lash back, but that destroys us. And so what I've learned is that it's all about love and forgiveness, but our love for the truth, our love for freedom that propels us forward and allows us to be a force to be reckoned with that ultimately has a positive outcome in the end. And so that's what it's about, is stay true to love.
Yeah, and I feel that from you. You know, I can, as I said, you know, right in the beginning, I can't imagine going through what you've gone through, and for you to sit here as a warrior of you know, the warrior of the light, of the truth, and you to just stay so centered. And to be able to talk about these things is very admirable. So, yeah. So again, thank you. Thank you for all that you do and you stand for, and for coming onto the show. For those of you listening out there, check out the show notes. I'll definitely be putting up some links to David, Facebook page, and of course also to True Hope and their website. And if you do enjoy the show, consider sharing this one. This is a really, really great episode. For very much outside the box from what we normally do, but I think very relevant as well, because it fosters a lot of discussion and opens up some things that I think we really need to start talking about and not just sort of bury our head in the sand. So yeah, so please subscribe, share, whatever you got to do to get the word out there. David, thank you once again for coming on the show, and we'll definitely catch up with you soon.
Thank you so much, Brett.
God bless you. Take care, and to you, brother.